Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guest today, Ross Guberman of Legal Writing Pro. He's also an author and an entrepreneur. And we're going to talk about all those facets of his career and life today. Thanks for joining us, Ross.
Hey, thanks for having me on and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you too. Our episodes air on Thursdays, so hopefully our guests aren't confused by that, but they know that we have some lead time in getting these episodes produced and ready to go. So we'll take a happy Friday any day of the week.
Absolutely.
So Ross, thanks for being with us today. We're looking forward to visiting with you, but I want to just, as we usually do in our show, give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our audience. We are the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, but we have trial lawyers and judges and other folks within and outside of Texas who listen to our show. But for anyone who doesn't know you, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what led you into law.
Sure. Yeah. Hello, Texas. So got into law in a somewhat strange way. I was actually doing graduate work in comparative literature and got kind of burned out very quickly just at the very start of the PhD program. And I was going to school at Yale and I ended up hanging out with a lot of Yale law students and I didn't know any lawyers. There really aren't too many in my family. So I didn't know anything about the law, but they were so animated all the time. They were, you know, flying off to Haiti. I remember this is dating myself. There was a crisis with Aristide. And a couple of them said, you know, you don't seem to like grad school too much. Why don't you go to law school? And I did. You know, that was in the 1990s. So I started law school in 95. And then kind of continuing the same pattern of being a little impulsive, I did practice and I did enjoy it, but I then stopped and I did a bunch of different things, including editing briefs. And I taught at the first online university. I started teaching at a law school in DC here at GW. And then one of the firms I wrote briefs for or edited briefs for asked me to put together a class for their associates. And that's kind of how the whole thing got started. So that was about 20 years ago.
Well, you've made a name for yourself as a legal writing expert. You've authored a couple of books and started a company called Legal Writing Pro. Was that the genesis of Legal Writing Pro, your early career and doing writing and instructing for law firms?
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, it seems like a smooth path, but of course, I had no idea when I got started whether it was going to work. I didn't really know exactly how I was going to structure things. It was a little bit happenstance-like. But one good thing with law firms, they tend to follow each other in a pack. So I did have the sense early on that you had to kind of break through the sort of Am Law 100 barrier. And then once you got through that barrier, or I should say, if you did, everything would be much easier. I did that first workshop that I mentioned that was very casual. And then I started pounding the pavement back then. Back then there was email, but it wasn't too efficient. And then you get a critical mass of clients. But it takes a while. And then things, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell says, you hit the tipping point and then it was much easier. But it's not an easy business to get into.
Were you doing like any ghostwriting advocacy kind of work for firms like that? Or were you mostly instructing other lawyers on how to write?
Yeah, I did. Kind of ghostwriting, as you put it. Different types of projects. They were actually pretty stimulating. And I was, you know, I was kind of working from home before it was cool because I didn't at that time have an official position with a firm. So yeah, I had a variety of projects, writing and editing. I also worked as a journalist during that time too. So that was another element. And yeah, I was kind of doing a lot of different things and hoping they would all congeal into a viable career path. And they did.
You were kind of on the early end. I feel like legal writing is sort of a subject of study has really taken off in the last 10 to 15 years. And it seems like you were kind of one of the early ones kind of pushing that out there, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it in law school. I loved the class, and that's fairly uncommon. I hear a lot of complaining. I was exposed to your fellow Texan, Brian Garner, even in, I think my first year of law school, or at least my second. So that sort of got me excited. I read his books and so forth. It's also true, as I said, that I had this literary analysis background, but that actually might be more of a coincidence than anything else. But certainly it was something that I gravitated toward, and starting it on the very first day of law school, that was the one thing I did actually understand and, you know, felt comfortable with. And then that was also, even when I was a summer associate, that was always my strength.
Were you able from there, I guess, to grow Legal Writing Pro beyond yourself? Because I mean, I know, as I said, we've talked about, you've got a couple of other things going on, but I'm curious about what direction you wound up taking Legal Writing Pro is in, because I know that's still out there and part of what you're doing. So tell us more about the company and what it's been up to.
Yeah, I mean, I probably, looking back now, probably took on too much. Certainly when I was younger, you know, 10 years ago or so, I know there was a year, I think it was 2009, I did something like 220 workshops. I had a week once with 11 workshops in six cities, including Saturday. So it was really, a lot of things are like this, you know, when it's your own business, you don't feel like you can say no, and you don't really want to say no because it's exciting. I got a lot of satisfaction out of what I did. It's not in the past tense, as you said, I still do it. So what really happened, I would say, is in addition to simply adding more and more clients all the time, which tended to be kind of the same types of firms over and over again, as I said, they all copy each other. I also expanded into different types of writing. So IP, contracts, you know, business development writing. So I had so many different things going on that it made it so, although I was on the road all the time and probably busier than I should have been, it was always very stimulating. And I was always trying to find new fields or new practices to explore or conquer.
How would you kind of go about learning a new field? You know, things like contract and business development. Was that something you had a background in, or did you just kind of have to take what you already knew and apply it to a new arena?
Well, I do have that sort of professional student thing where when I'm older, I do enjoy throwing myself into some new field or hobby or something that sometimes something obscure that I've just never really had a chance to put my arms around. So, but some of that I did have probably had most of what I needed, like business development writing. I certainly had to mind the journalistic style when you're a lawyer and still be authoritative. But obviously things like patent prosecution or stock purchase agreements, you have to be much more rigorous. The one thing that has often separated me, though, is I always have my ear to practitioners. So there are a lot of kind of pie in the sky consultants out there in legal writing and otherwise. So, and I'm also very extroverted and I love meeting people. So I learned a lot from actual practicing lawyers when it came to what they actually wanted to learn or what they found challenging in these different practice areas. I think that helped me a lot, too.
Yeah, I love your reference to Gladwell's tipping point, because I think that's a very accurate description. You know, you do reach a point where suddenly the thing takes on a life that's greater than just you. And then eventually you have to, as an entrepreneur, even though it is tempting to take every assignment or every client that comes in, you know, you have to be a little more selective, or else you'll be doing things that aren't as productive or profitable, and you wouldn't get to spend as much time at home. I'm sure that travel schedule you described was a bit grueling.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always embarrassed to say this, but I actually am. I really love business travel. I don't know if I just grew to love it or it's something just in me, but for some reason, I never really got tired of the kind of rat race of going from one airport to the next and to hotels, because I always found something enjoyable on a lot of these trips. Saw someone or did something, went to some restaurant I'd heard about. And of course, there were moments where I was exhausted like anybody else, and you have the usual, the nightmare flight cancellations in a blizzard. But again, I found it all really pretty fun. And I was also really grateful. I mean, I'm going to wherever I'm going, LA or Cleveland, on someone else's dime. And I'm also the one who decided to accept the invitation. So it isn't like I have all these clients that are kind of ordering me to show up to take depositions. So I always felt like I was pretty lucky. And also I didn't have to work, you know, some, what I think grinds people down who travel a lot is they have a really tough work day, you know, sometimes through 6 p.m., 7 p.m., and then they run to the airport and they're stressed out and they land at midnight or you don't have a chance to have a normal meal. And I didn't have that. My actual work was not stressful and I didn't have surprises over time. I always knew when I was supposed to start, when I was supposed to stop.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly. And Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedeas bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
I want to get into the book, Point Made. And just to give everyone the full title, it's Point Made, How to Write Like the Nation's Top Advocates. And I think it's now in the second edition, which made me feel old because I remember the first edition quite well. But this is really, I think, a great resource for folks who are wanting to learn how to improve their legal writing. Tell us about how you decided to write the book and what your approach was. What was going through your mind as you decided to do this?
Well, it's a good story that, again, will make me look kind of passive because, as with the other thing we discussed, it was somebody else's idea. So what happened is I wrote an article about the Chief Justice. You know, this was early on when, you know, I knew his reputation as a brief writer. This is right before the time he was put on, nominated for the Supreme Court and then instantly Chief Justice. So I had, the article was called Five Ways to Write Like John Roberts. And it was something that I spent a fair amount of time on, but I can't remember how I distributed it because, of course, there was, we didn't have social media, but somehow it got a really, really wide following. And Oxford University Press, this editor there, who's very smart, very savvy guy, saw it. And it was his idea for me to write Point Made. So he contacted me and said he thought this was incredible. They tried to break these things down into steps. And had I thought of writing a book. So I did. I mean, it's, you look at books, I mean, I'm now finishing the third edition, supposedly, and you look at it, it doesn't seem like it would be that hard, but believe me, it's hard, especially the first book. Point Made was my first book, and I would have done some things differently, but I also think it was an absolutely incredible experience to immerse myself in great advocacy and great brief writing and try to figure out what the heck's going on and make it concrete and try to break it into 50 tips, 50 lawyers and the like. So it was a big project.
What was your process for writing the book?
Well, messy. Again, these things seem obvious not only in hindsight to me, but it was also difficult back then to get briefs. You didn't have these online libraries. So I had kind of like an absent-minded professor approach. I had, you know, stacks of briefs everywhere and I did have people working for me. But at some point I had to sort of settle on a set of techniques and try to make them pretty concrete. And then I also had to stop collecting briefs. Again, I'm not ashamed to say I really do love what I do. So I actually did want to keep reading and staying in a sort of student mode. But at some point, I felt like I'd kind of figured it out. Like, here are 50 techniques, 50 advocates. I would pick up a stack and try to find good examples. I mean, the truth is, even if you read a brief by a luminary, it takes a while to find something that's not only really great, but something that you could actually share and explain, right? Because out of context, a lot of sentences wouldn't be meaningful. So, you know, I traded excerpts, I think, and reconsidered some names. But once I got to that part, then it was pretty easy. Then putting all that together in a book was pretty easy. It was really just figuring out how to break advocacy down to 50 techniques.
Yeah, I can imagine the funneling process for that could easily get really extensive if you weren't willing to kind of cut yourself off at a certain point.
Yeah, so speaking of being old, I look at the 50 I had in the first edition and some have passed away. Some have been mired in scandal. You can't freeze time. You want to like say, hey, this is the negative profession. I'm trying to be positive. Here are 50 great people, but they didn't get the memo that they're supposed to behave and stick around, you know, to keep my list timely.
I'm trying to imagine going through that process before the age of readily electronically available briefs, either on Westlaw Lexis or I guess Pacer was around, but you still had to find them. It wasn't some brief bank that you could just go and pick and choose from that would give you great examples of the points you're making in the book. And that's one of the things that I think is so helpful about the book is being able to flip to a specific point and seeing examples of the point being illustrated in the book by advocates that most of us have heard of. It also reminds me, you know, of Barack Obama, having been a lawyer and advocate. You've got a few examples. It may be in the first edition and not the second, can't remember, but it's really neat to see different examples from folks who are in lawyer households anyway, maybe household names.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I tried to have a diverse set. Obviously, especially nowadays, people will criticize any selection, but I did try to put some kind of surprising names in there. I think I had some Texan personal injury lawyers in there too. I mean, I tried not to be too biased toward my own familiar zone of huge law firms. Third edition will be the same. Some people are out, and then I've got some new people coming in.
Well, I'll just identify one of the Texans that you're referencing, and that's Joe Jamail. And there's a reference in here, a phrase from him about hoodwinking Wall Street and cooking the books. So
that's the G-rated stuff. I think he got a little more colorful than that.
You know,
it's a fan book's supposed to be suitable for, you know, kids maybe too. So
sure. So
I think he had quite a personality.
He did.
What I understand. I know I saw a video clip, this kind of infamous deposition video clip with him, and he was not a wallflower.
Not a bit. His reputation definitely preceded him. In your approach between the editions, are you looking to really update the lessons much, or is it more about providing sort of refreshing the examples that you're giving in the book?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Does advocacy really change, or does it just seem like it is? For example, we wouldn't want to draw a lot of conclusions right now. When we're just getting out of COVID, I think people are thinking that some things have changed in trials, even in logistical matters related to hearings and depositions, even brief writing. I don't think advocacy changes that quickly, but it's possible that what makes somebody stick out changes or different. You have different priorities. So I try to be sensitive to that. I mean, just I think an example would be when I wrote the first edition, I know I have a chapter in there. It's kind of thin chapter about tables or graphs or, you know, visual aids. And nowadays, that's actually much more important, much more common, and much less controversial. So some things do change. But yeah, I try to look back even for another purpose this morning. I was looking at Marshall's Brown v. Board of Education brief. And although the types of words change, I mean, it's a more formal style than we would see in the last 20 years, a lot of what made that brief great, very similar to what would make briefs great today. But yeah, it's also, I think what people think of as a great advocate might be changing too. It's just because there is this push to have more diversity and not be maybe so elitist. So I'm trying to be sensitive to that as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about visuals, and I'll look forward to seeing the third edition, because I think we've had some guests on the show that have talked about visuals and briefs and how important they can be and how useful they can be in illustrating very complex concepts. I'm also curious about, this has been what, about a more than 15-year total project, I'm guessing, for you. Have you seen much change in the form of legal writing in terms of, we were taught in the age of Brian Garner and let's use active voice and let's avoid the passive and that sort of thing. But are you seeing shorter sentences and really breaking it down into more simplistic terms? Or, I mean, are there any generalizations like that that you can even draw?
Yeah, that's also a fascinating question. I mean, I try to be empirical about these things because of Brief Catch. I do have a bunch of tools, analytical tools, statistical tools that can measure whether things are changing. So The truth is there were, if you go back, even like Holmes and Jackson in their own ways were very, very, I wouldn't say conversational, but they had a very, very direct personal style. I know it seems like we're getting better. We're getting further away from kind of people call like old fashioned or archaic writing. I'm not totally sure that's the case, though. I don't see that with law students, for example. I don't see any, if anything, I feel like they're more formalistic now and a little stiffer than even when I started. At the same time, if you want to get attention right now, if you want to get attention as a, you know, an appellate advocate, or frankly, as a circuit court judge, although your sentences are not necessarily crisper and shorter, you are rewarded, or at least you get in the news, so to speak, if you do things that are a little bit out there, like pop culture or kind of strange analogies or really, really overheated. Well, overheated, of course, is a loaded term, but let's just say fiery rhetoric. So it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure sentences are getting better. I think that's probably more of a myth that people are writing more in plain English, whether they should or not. But the kinds of things people talk about and the techniques they use are definitely getting more conversational. What I would like would be to preserve some of that. I understand our culture is also much more casual now, so some of that is good. But sometimes I think people take something a little hokey or corny, like a little quip or a movie reference, and think that that's really what makes you a great writer. I mean, it may or may not, depending on the context, even if it's something that does work for the occasion, as you were suggesting before, what really matters is not whether you have something from the latest Game of Thrones in your first paragraph, which is always what the legal media will cover, right? But what about when that fun part is over and you're actually analogizing and distinguishing case law and doing textual analysis of statutes? There are many fewer people good at writing about those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, kind of a lot of things coming together, right? There's more and more of a celebrity culture, especially for judges, but also for lawyers. We're getting more casual, but it takes a lot of very foundational writing skills to write really crisply and clearly. It's not like it's a switch you can just turn on and say, oh, I got it. I'm not going to write in convoluted prose. I'm not going to use these legalisms. I mean, you have to have total control over, you know, what you're trying to get across and the links between the points and the most reader-friendly ways to articulate them. I think it's a lot harder than people realize.
Have you seen changes in kind of the approaches that good advocates are using from switching from paper to electronic briefing?
Well, certainly hyperlinking cases, hyperlinks in general. I know a lot of judges appreciate that. I believe some courts are now requiring it. I know it makes a lot of people's lives easier, right? They don't have to have that mad rush to file something. But otherwise, I don't really see, at least from my own vantage point, that technology and the fact that you can file things electronically, and I'm not necessarily sure that those are making people more efficient or more effective in themselves, right? So it probably depends on what tools you're using and whether you're taking the time you now don't have to spend, you know, driving to the courthouse or getting someone else to, and actually using that time and energy to up your game. And sometimes if the mechanical part of writing is too easy, it can make us a little soft. And there's got to be a happy medium.
Well, that book is a great reference for legal writers, really of all ilks. But you took the time to write another book geared specifically to judges. That one is Point Taken, How to Write Like the World's Greatest Judges. And what strikes me about that title is, did you actually go outside the U.S.?
I did. I mean, you know, I had to cut it off somewhere. There are a lot of countries out there. As you can guess, I needed to stick to English-speaking jurisdictions, too. But you know, I have some Brits. You've got Lady Hale, I know, and Sumption, who's now on the high court there, an Australian justice, Kirby, some Canadians as well. That part was really fun for me, and I've gotten to go abroad and work with judges. But what I really know would be the American judiciary. And, you know, frankly, if there's one thing that even right now with global tensions, we're still sort of the leader of, it would be judicial opinion writing. I mean, everywhere I go outside the country, back when we could go outside the country easily, of course, that is one thing I really noticed that people, you know, they all know Scalia, Kagan, and Roberts. I mean, they know their names, they know their styles, they have all these questions for me. So we've done something, you know, I know there are issues, of course, with the judiciary, but the overall level of opinion writing in America is much higher than people realize because they haven't had the chance to read opinions from these other countries, which are really, really often almost impenetrable. Yeah. So the problem with judges is, you know, they don't get any feedback. I mean, everybody kisses their you-know-what all day long, 24 hours a day. So this is also around the time I started being invited to train all the federal judges. And you have to kind of think through what you're actually going to do when you get up there and try to purport to tell judges how to write better opinions.
I guess one question I have is, do any of them ever say, well, Mr. Guberman, how many opinions have you written?
You know, it's funny because I still remember the first time I spoke at a circuit court conference. It wasn't the really friendly Fifth Circuit. It was the Eighth Circuit, though, which is pretty nice, right? Midwestern. But I was very concerned about that, right? But to be honest, when I've gotten that kind of reaction, it's from like summer associates, believe it or not. I never get it from law firm partners, and I definitely never get it from judges, for knock on wood. And I think it's because I'm very, very careful. And it's also intuitive for me. It's natural because I wouldn't even dream of thinking that I could just come up with my own system of writing opinions. So what I've always done with judges is kind of like what you're talking about with Point Made, just trying to look at judges widely renowned, right? Kind of universally respected, and then just try to show other judges exactly what those judges are doing. And I think for that reason, I've had 100% positive experiences with judges, including the Supreme Court justices, very, very confident circuit court judges I've come in contact with. They're actually really, really curious and much more open-minded than you might think.
Is the most intelligent legal research tool on the market in your slate of legal technology? Westlaw Edge is powered by the most advanced artificial intelligence available. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to be more efficient and stay competitive by delivering the fastest answers and most valuable insights for a clear strategic advantage. Capitalize on Westlaw Edge's AI features and be confident that you're getting results you can rely on to serve your clients better than before.
I suspect that, at least with the new judges, one of the tasks is to inform them, if they don't already know, of the real function of judicial writing, which is to convey the decisions in a way that the reader, the consumer of the American legal system, can understand. If that's true, then I can see why judges would be open-minded to suggestions on how to present their opinions, because I hear you describe those dense opinions from other countries, and it makes me think about reading a Texas case from 100 years ago, and you can't ever figure out what the court is actually doing.
There are quite a few today, too, like that. I don't want to overhype the quality in America, yes.
Yeah.
In Texas, I've read my own share of Texas cases that were not easy reads as well. Not many of the ones listening to the podcast, of course.
No, definitely not.
Because they obviously have really good taste. but, you know, to your point, I'm always careful not to say anything that I learned from all these judges. But the truth is, I don't think they really know, because the legal system doesn't know and society doesn't know. I'm not sure they really know what they're actually aiming for. So I think you said something about making it understandable to the community. And the thing is, are you really supposed to make it understandable to high school students, which is what Justice Thomas said he strives for? Are you supposed to make it understandable to educated adults? Are you supposed to make it understandable to the parties, but not necessarily anyone else, assuming that very few people will ever read it? Are you supposed to make it good for law students? The main constituency of judicial opinions, law students, right? Are you supposed to make it understandable to lawyers? So it's not really clear, and certainly not clear to me either, what exactly you're supposed to do. At least when people write briefs, even if they find it really, really tedious or challenging or both, they at least understand what they're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to convince a judge or a panel of your client's position. But with opinion writing, not clear at all, right? So people say don't grandstand, right? Or don't do anything clever. And then these judges, I'm not saying we should feel sorry for them, but I can see why they get frustrated. They see all the ones that get all the praise do what some would call grandstanding, right? Or drawing attention to themselves. So then they're trying to figure it out. Well, wait a second. I just did something. They're saying, look how accessible it is to cite Hamilton or The Bachelor. And then the other judges hear that and they think, oh, so what you're supposed to do is write for the masses, like write an opinion that anybody can understand. But then they get criticized for that. So then they try to be more formal. And then people complain that their opinions are too pretentious or pompous. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point about the different audiences that are susceptible to the judicial legal writing, opinion writing. Well, I can appreciate how difficult it must be to go in and try and teach federal judges how to write opinions. I've already expressed gratitude on behalf of the bar for your helping lawyers write better briefs.
Absolutely.
Another function of our podcast, besides talking about nuts and bolts things like legal writing, is to talk about legal technology. And one of the things that I've seen coming from you a lot lately is a lot of discussion of the product Briefcatch. And we're interested in ways that technology can help lawyers write better briefs, research better. And we're also interested in educating lawyers on these tools, because these are things that, unless you happen to troll Ross Guterman on Twitter, you might not necessarily know about some of the things that are going on out there. And we're privileged to be members of Appellate Twitter, so we're already fairly well educated. But tell us about Briefcatch. Well, first of all, what it is and how you got started with that.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt that it's a really exciting time for legal tech. I mean, the general press says that legal tech is the hottest tech sector right now, which is, you know, we're not usually at the vanguard of things. So hats off to, you know, America's lawyers. So as I did all these workshops over the years, and I still do them, I did one yesterday, got one on Monday on Zoom, I would meet a lot of people who would say that they take my classes or even follow me around and take them more than once, but they found it hard to remember everything, let alone put it into practice. So early on, people would say, talk about macros, like, could you make a macro, like a word macro? And then, of course, you realize macros are kind of not really a solution if you're trying to take everything you want to help people with and make it widely available. So I ended up looking into making my own software, which is a fairly intimidating thing. You have to figure out what you're going to do. You have to find a developer, obviously. So I did do all that. There was some trial and error. I certainly didn't end up with the first developer I hired, I can tell you that much. And then it launched, you know, a few years ago, and it's really been fantastic. I mean, I'm very grateful how it's gone. I mean, today I just released or launched a new version, so that's actually kind of a big deal. Hopefully I don't seem too tired. I think I slept about 30 minutes last night. And it's also, again, I don't want to make myself into some kind of angel. I mean, I make money off of it. It's for profit, but it's also helped a lot of solo practitioners, you know, people who live in other countries who have to write legal documents in English much of the time or some of the time. A lot of law schools are buying it now. So it also teaches a lot, which is not something I think people focus on as much. The main point is to let you instantly edit your legal work product or other types of writing too, but it really is designed for lawyers and judges. So it's going to take something like 10,200 different rules. It will look at your blue booking and fix that. It will give you all sorts of powerful verb choices to replace 3, 4, 5 word phrases. It makes observations about even the way you're using case law. So it does all sorts of things to your product if you want to polish it up. But especially this new version, I have a lot of tips and tricks and explanations. And then one reason I've been up so late is I have now added a couple of sentences for every example. So if there's something about replacements for accordingly, instead of just giving people options, I have something, I think, from Ginsburg, from Chief Justice Roberts, Paul Clement. I mean, I'll have different sentences now so people can actually have a little bit of inspiration too. So it's really exciting. I mean, again, it was just luck that I happened to do this when legal tech was really starting to take off, but I'm certainly not done. I have other ideas, and lots of the biggest law firms have now bought it. Some of the Supreme Court justices use it. I've never shared any names, of course. So it's really, really been fun.
Did you have any background in software or software development, or was it just you just sort of took a chance on it?
I'm the one who like can't turn my iPhone off or on. So definitely no. Although I will say I was not hopeless. I have had to learn a natural language processing system for coding my rules. So it is sort of like coding. And of course, just as a, because I'm a customer of software development and I hire people, I've learned more than I thought I would about how it all works. And as I said, I'm a professional student, so I've enjoyed that part too. But no, I definitely stay away from the actual coding. I don't want to cause all the electricity to go out or everybody's computer to crash.
Well, what a neat product. I was thinking about something like this the other day. It wasn't all that long ago that the only thing available to us as legal writers was a spell checker in our software. And now there are different grammar checkers out there and
good research tools right now too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for certain. And many of them are either standalone products or Microsoft Word add-ins. Is that the way that BriefCatch works, is as a Word add-in?
So it is a Word add-in, but I can't say too much, but we have something very exciting coming out in about 6 weeks. So all I'll say is it will not only be a Word add-in very soon. One thing with lawyers, though, is that you know, there's a lot of wariness about things being on the cloud. So that's why it was originally a Word add-in.
Well, I love the cloud myself. I think it's a very beneficial thing. There is something to be said for being able just to click a button in Microsoft Word and being able to run, have a piece of software run on your document right then and there. And I've used a few that will actually do track changes to the document, which I actually find very helpful. But it sounds like you're looking at sort of the next big thing for BriefCatch and how to deliver that product out to your audience.
Yeah, I mean, to make it really effective, you need to give people choices and you need to let them kind of think, right? So it's the same as when you have a human editor. You don't want to just turn your brain off and just sit back. So what we're finding is actually the more we kind of give people prompts or examples, the more confident they feel and the more engaged they are. So it's kind of the perfect marriage. You want to use the best parts of technology without letting it kind of control you. You want to remain an active player, I think, at all times. And that's also why I think some of these newer research projects are taking off, because you're still thinking through your client's problem. It's just that the artificial intelligence engines help you find the cases you need much more efficiently.
It kind of seems like that is one of the overarching trends in legal tech is efficiency, because the lawyers are seeing the benefits of it. The clients are seeing the benefits of it. And certainly the courts are too, with docket loads what they are. And so it kind of seems like so many products are geared toward that end.
Yeah. I mean, the flip side of that is there's a lot of consternation, I think, especially in law firms, because let's be honest, efficiency is not always the number one priority for lawyers when you're billing. And there's some fear that a lot of these tools will end up replacing core functions that lawyers now occupy. I just think it's kind of a cynical way to think, number one, but number two, it doesn't matter, right? Because the clients want efficiency. And the thing is, you can use technology. I mean, nobody wants to pay $1,000 an hour for blue booking. One thing I notice on a lot of these Supreme Court briefs is there sometimes there are two spaces between sentences when otherwise they're at one. So there's not one client out there who wants to pay these rates for that when BriefCatch and other products too can catch that in 100 millionth of a second. So ideally, you know, as people look forward, there will be more time for strategy and client counseling and thinking things through. And those are all high value enterprises and functions that cannot be replaced by AI, right? So then we can kind of resolve this leeriness that a lot of people now feel. I mean, they're worried about being made defunct.
Well, the other thing that we've talked about a lot on this show that sometimes gets lost in this conversation is it opens a tremendous potential for access to justice for people that are kind of underserved right now.
It's so true. I mean, Obviously, a legal research product would be great for that. Editing products like mine and others, really great. But then there's also this kind of growing, you know, document automation sector, if you want to call it a sector, that kind of LegalZoom would be sort of an example of something that already exists, but is more static. I mean, this would be something that would be more adaptable and more tailored, but also easy enough to use that you don't need necessarily to spend your life savings to write, get a simple will, right? Or to even to, if you decide to get some investment property and you want to rent it out, people shouldn't need to hire a real estate lawyer, you know, for a very simple lease. And then you kind of see that with contracts, but I think it's going to happen in litigation too. I mean, Case Text, which I have a marketing arrangement with, I should disclose. I mean, Case Text has this incredible product called Compose that actually takes things like motions to transfer venue, which are pretty predictable, right? I mean, they all kind of follow the same factors and talk about the same facts. And turns out what I consider a pretty darn good draft of a motion to transfer venue. And I always think when I see it, how many lawyers right now in America are just sitting there like frustrated? What are the factors again? And how do you know if it's convenient for the witnesses? And I think litigation is behind contracts. You can, again, a lot more legal tech right now in the AI space for contracts, but we're next. Briefs and motions are next.
Well, you mentioned some of the areas in which there's clearly room for efficiency to be driven by technology. I mean, site checking a brief, checking the style. I mentioned spell check. I mean, this is a spell check on steroids. It does a lot more than that. And by the way, I've loved what you said about using examples. It sounds like you're kind of wedding Point Made to some degree with Brief Catch, but by giving those examples from folks whose legal writing ought to be trusted and held up as exemplar.
Yeah, that's a really great point, because I'm also trying to look ahead. Even when I'm dead or fully retired, I still care about students and the profession. And I think ideally what we're heading to is a place where people will be constantly learning on the job through tools, right? So, I mean, I've made a fortune giving workshops. I'm not going to say anything bad about three-hour workshops, and people seem to think they're really, really helpful. But given just the realities of how I see young people changing with their attention spans and the like, this is almost for sure going to be the wave of the future. I mean, I'm sure it's going to even seep down to high school, junior high too, that everything isn't going to be in like 1 hour or 3 hour teaching or training blocks. So that's exactly as you said. I was thinking that myself at 4 a.m. last night, that I've now basically gotten most of Point Made into Brief Catch, the parts that people would really remember, right? Because what they really get out of Brief Catch, I mean, sorry, Point Made would be the examples, and the way I explain them sometimes helps people too, but that's all in there now. So I think you're onto something, right? You could start in the law schools, since there's such concern about being prepared for practice. If they actually could, instead of just saying, okay, go write a memo for the first semester, go write an appellate brief. If they could be actually getting help and getting examples and seeing what's out there and like understanding how actual lawyers really write these things, I think could be incredibly educational and more enjoyable too. I mean, I never saw any of these things in law school. I never saw a motion or a contract.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think we've reached the point at which we thought we might let you get back to your regular daily schedule and maybe, it sounds like, get some sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't do naps though. I've never been able to take naps. So
I wouldn't
just caffeine. Thought, caffeine's my answer.
Supposedly by this stage of an entrepreneur's life, you're not supposed to have to pull the all-nighters anymore, but you clearly are very hands-on with your product. And I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But one thing we like to do is invite our guests at the end of each show to offer a tip or a war story. So we wanted to give you that chance to do that as well. Did you have anything you might want to share with our audience?
Yeah. I mean, I'll share something like a little touchy-feely, maybe appropriate for the times where everybody's sort of coming out of their caverns and going back to the real world, so to speak. So the one thing I would say, especially to people on the younger side in the profession, first 10 to 20 years, is there's an enormous amount of negativity about the profession on social media. I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. I would never have gone to law school if I had seen all the terrible, negative, constant, nasty, negative comments. And I love law Twitter, right? That's a lot of my exposure. So what I would say is you get praised a lot for being snarky and saying everything sucks and the whole profession's corrupt. But I've seen over and over and over again for 20 years that you want to go and like find something within the profession, whether it be a, like a subset of a practice area or a group of lawyers that do things you find interesting or stimulating. Even though you don't get nearly as much attention for being happy as a lawyer, everybody seems to want to hear tales of woe. There are a lot of really happy lawyers out there. There really are, but they're actually afraid to say they're happy. They're somehow it's twisted into you don't realize how miserable you're supposed to be. So that's what I would say. I mean, writing is a good example, by the way. You'd think, gosh, teaching legal writing would be a nightmare. Like even if you could make a lot of money, people are defensive. They already think they know everything. Plus grammar is boring. I could have done all that, looked at it that way too, right? But I found it, I tried to be really positive and really excited. And guess what? It's contagious, right? So that'd be my thought for the week, other than wondering why I stayed up till 5 in the morning, 6 nights in a row is. So I think law Twitter is great, but it's really toxic too. And I just think we all need to stop rewarding the critics all the time, right? There are all these great stories, people doing fantastic things, and there's just not nearly enough attention on all that.
That makes a lot of sense. And you're absolutely right. It's worth remembering that a lot of people are very happy in their legal careers, but they just don't go to Twitter to talk about it necessarily.
Yeah, but you would be like mocked a lot of the time if you said something positive about law. I said something positive about law school once and people acted like it was scandalous. I said something really off the wall, like, I enjoyed law school. And you're not allowed to say that, apparently.
There's always going to be a hater.
That's right. Well, Ross, we really appreciate you giving us your time today. This has been a great conversation and it's really been fun to learn about this. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks to both of you and I hope you have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.